The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with an article from the April 28, 2021 online issue of the New Yorker magazine. What We Can and Can't Learn from a New Translation of the Gospels by Casey Sepp. Some years ago, in a fit of religious enthusiasm, I decided that I wanted to learn Greek. This was so that I could read the New Testament in its original language, a desire that I could not really explain, other than as a general sense that I was seeking more from Scripture. I was heartened when a classicist friend, knowing how bad I was at learning languages, reassured me that the kind of Greek I needed to learn for this project, it was not the difficult kind, the Attic Greek that he and his colleagues read, but rather the Koine Greek, which he described as Dick and Jane Primer Greek, which would be much easier. I remember all of this somewhat bitterly because I still struggled with Koine. After memorizing a grammar book and what seemed like enough flashcards to account for all 5,000 or so distinct words that appear in the New Testament, I began trying to get through the Gospel of John, supposedly the easiest of the books, and then Apostle Paul's more difficult letter to the Galatians. It should have helped that I knew these texts well enough to summarize whole chapters and quote many verses from memory. But it didn't. In the end, all of the hours that I poured into my pidgin Greek resulted in little more than an abiding admiration for those whose calling it is to translate sacred literature. It's not that I lacked for other biblical translations at the time. My grandmother raised me on the King James Version, but my childhood church followed the common lectionary with weekly readings from the New Revised Standard Version, which is also what we were required to use when we went through confirmation. Over the years, I've collected 24 or so others, a red-letter version in which the words of Christ appear in color, a handful of editions annotated by scholars, some illustrated with sketches or maps, and a few truly wild editions, such as the novelist Reynolds Price's Three Gospels, which leaves out Matthew and Luke, but includes one Price himself wrote called An Honest Account of a Memorable Life, an apocryphal gospel. The Bible has been translated into more than 700 languages, and there are hundreds of versions in English alone, going as far back as the one produced by the 14th century reformer John Wycliffe and his Bible men, better known as Lollards, and continuing in the last half century with everything from the Living Bible, a plain-spoken paraphrase by Kenneth Taylor, first published in the 1970s, to Clarence Jordan's Civil Rights Era Cotton Patch Gospel, in which the Holy Land is transposed to the American South. Instead of being crucified in Jerusalem, Jesus is lynched in Atlanta. To compare any two of these translations is to see how elastic phrases can become, their meaning stretching until one thing becomes something else entirely. Even those readers without any Greek at all can appreciate how theologies shape and are shaped by the text, with significance written into certain words and written out of others. To encounter the text in its original language seems to promise a way out of such superimpositions. The real language of God, or the authentic version of what Christ commanded. Such temptations lurk in the margins of any holy text, which is why even struggling language learners like me have tried to master Koine Greek, and why translations like one just published by Sarah Rudin, simply titled The Gospels, A New Translation, hold such appeal. A Quaker philologist, Rudin has translated Augustine's Confessions and Virgil's Aeneid, along with plays by Aeschylus, Sophocles, and Euripides. Her critical books include a commentary on biblical translation called The Face of Water, and another on the Apostle Paul called Paul Among the People. Like those earlier works, her new translation of the four canonical accounts of Christ's life is somewhat both clever and wry, serious and sincere. In her introduction, Rudin notes that her preference is to deal with the Gospels more straightforwardly than is customary. And, in a sense, she does, producing a version that is, by turns, fascinating and maddening. What would it mean to deal with the Gospels straightforwardly? First of all, as Rudin points out, it might well mean ceasing to call them Gospels, a word that comes to us not directly from the Greek, but from Old English, specifically from the felicitous cognate gospel, meaning good news. This is what the original readers of the Gospels would have called them, evangelion. She does at least offer readers the convenience of chapter and verse numbers, a convention that took hold only in the 16th century, which allows easy reference to other translations, including to the parallel Greek-English text on which Rudin based her translation, the Nestle-Aland Novum Testamentum Gris. A wonderful thing about reading the Bible in the digital age is that the casual student need not try to recreate St. Jerome's library. There are fine digital resources like the website Bible Gateway, which contains dozens of translations that can be compared chapter by chapter, and Bible Hub, which offers an interlinear Bible keyed to the Greek and Hebrew text, allowing anyone to page verse by verse through the diagrammed ancient languages and a full concordance of usage and meaning. But none of this renders the Gospels especially straightforward. Even if you have the Greek good news in one hand and Rudin's translation in the other. One reason is the very language in which they were written. It is an open question how much Greek of any kind Jesus' own circle understood or used, Rudin writes in her introduction. Nearly all of the words attributed to them are thus in a language they may never have voluntarily uttered, belonging to a cosmopolitan civilization they may well have despised. Jesus, in all likelihood, spoke Aramaic and some Hebrew, not the Greek in which his speech is recorded, and the Gospels themselves were most likely written down between 3 and 7 decades after his death. Still, plenty of contemporaneous Jews knew Greek, which is why the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible, was undertaken and was soon in such wide circulation, used throughout the diaspora for worship and teaching. For Rudin, then, it's important to read the preserved text as thoughtfully as possible, while always remembering that they are both temporally and linguistically removed from the events they record and the communities they represent. With those transliterated names, for instance, she says nothing could be precisely what was heard in Judea, in a different language family and represented by a different alphabet. But the halfway nature of the names in Greek is itself a good reminder that the text was, even in its rudiments, a squinting struggle to see Jesus' world. A straightforward squint it is, then, of Jesus, the Anointed One, as Rudin calls him in the opening verse of Mark's Gospel. From there, she carves her own rocky, rough-hewn path through four versions of the life of Christ. A verse just down the page conveys some of her deliberately awkward style. Ioannes, the baptizer, appeared in the wasteland, announcing baptism to change people's purpose and absolve them from their offenses. Compare that to the work of the nearly 50 translators who together created the King James Version. John did baptize in the wilderness and preach the baptism of repentance for the remission of sins. Rudin strips away theologically laden words like repentance and sin, returning what she calls the self-expressive text, which she laments has fallen under the muffling alien weight of later Christian institutions and had the life nearly smothered out of it. Perhaps, but one translator's smothering is another's reasoned attempt at conveying the meaning of distinctive concepts, as opposed to just distinct words. Consider Holy Spirit, which Rudin renders as life breath, and heaven, which she occasionally translates as the kingdom of the skies. Elsewhere, though, her effort to present the original text without baggage or cliché produces more engaging results, livelier dialogue, as when the disciples call Jesus boss instead of master, and when Pontius Pilate, prior to the crucifixion, says, "Look at this guy," instead of "Behold the man," and less specialized language, as when she substitutes analogies for parables and rescue for salvation. Sometimes Rudin's choices make sense of passages that earlier translations obscured. My favorite example of this involves a story found in both Mark and Matthew about the Syrophoenician woman who asks Christ to heal her daughter. Previous translations have rendered this story in such a way that Jesus seems both cold and rude, rebuking a Gentile who only wants to help her suffering child. In the New Revised Standard Version, for instance, when the Syrophoenician woman kneels before him pleading her case, his refusal sounds harsh. "It is not fair to take the children's food and throw it to the dogs." But Rudin points out that what most translators render as dogs is actually a cute diminutive form, the rare and comical little doggies, something less like an insult than like the kind of playful language you find in Aristophanes, a word choice so obviously tender and funny that it explains why, instead of leaving, the woman feels comfortable responding to Jesus in kind, saying in Rudin's version of Matthew, "Yes, master, but the little doggies do eat some of the crumbs that fall from their master's table." That reply, evidence of the woman's faith in God's grace as sufficiently abundant for Jews and Gentiles alike, impresses Jesus so much that he heals her daughter right away. I'd have been grateful for Rudin's translation if only for those little doggies. But she finds similar humor and humanity elsewhere in the original text, and brings much of her own to the notes and commentary. A welcome tone, since scholarly editions can sometimes be rendered dull by excessive piety. Sacred literature is rightfully loved and cherished, but too often that love can creep toward idolatry, shaping the text into something fixed and static, when ideally it is shaping us every time we encounter it. For all its idiosyncrasies, the rather emaciated joyful favor for grace, the literal but inscrutable play actors for hypocrites, and hung on the stakes for crucified, Rudin's translation does return much of the Gospels to the fresh clay from which they were made before they hardened into their familiar forms. Take the third chapter of John, when a Pharisee named Nicodemus comes to Jesus under cover of darkness to ask about the miracles he was performing around Galilee. Their exchange is the source of the born-again language that animates denominations of Christianity around the globe. As Rudin renders it, Jesus tells Nicodemus that, quote, "unless someone is born anew, taking it from the top, he can't see the kingdom of heaven," end quote. Anew, or again, and from above are all perfectly appropriate translations of the words that Jesus uses. He's deploying a pun, which Rudin conveys to contemporary readers with the slightly wordier, almost hokey, "taking it from the top." Unsure of what Jesus means, Nicodemus asks, "How can a person be born when he's old?" He can hardly go into his mother's womb a second time and then be born again, can he? It's a puzzling passage, the subject of so many sermons and theologies and conversion stories, that it's refreshing to read Rudin's droll gloss. Quote, Nicodemus never does understand what Jesus is saying about salvation, nor, apparently, is he meant to, nor, actually, can I, end quote. Understanding is what many people seek from sacred literature and what the people in the Gospels sought in their own encounters with Jesus. Sometimes this is readily available, and the obstacle, if any, is not comprehension, but commitment. Would that it were only a problem of translation that kept so many of us from answering Christ's call in Matthew 25 to feed the hungry, provide hospitality to the stranger, and visit the imprisoned. But elsewhere, the meaning of the Gospels can be genuinely elusive. Reading Sarah Rudin's translation during Lent, I was struck by how often those who meet Jesus do not understand his teachings. Even the disciples who knew him so well, observed him so closely, and heard so many of his sermons, not even they understand much of what he tells them. They beg him for explanations of his parables, express puzzlement over his invocation of earlier scriptures, and seem confused when his prophecies actually come to pass, including, as hundreds of millions of Christians celebrated on Easter Sunday, his very resurrection. That confusion and misprision is, of course, quite like our own, which is why so many of us return to the scriptures regularly in worship and in private or communal study, because when it comes to understanding, reading the Gospels once is never enough. That is not because we are reading the wrong version. The idea that any single translation can clarify the Bible's ambiguities and reveal its singular meaning is the fiction of fundamentalism. Even some of those who believe the text to be inerrant or the inspired word of God do not disrespect it by suggesting it is simple or straightforward. At present, we are awash in fine translators who strive for what are heralded as more accurate, historically sensitive versions. Not only Rudin with the Gospels, but Robert Alter with his The Hebrew Bible, and David Bentley Hart with what he calls, quote, an almost piteously literal, the New Testament. Yet no amount of fidelity in translation can solve the mysteries of what these texts mean, or clarify what was obscure even to the original audiences who confronted no language barrier. Those men and women who encountered Jesus in his ministry, and the authors of these earliest records of his life and death, and resurrection, struggled for words that adequately conveyed their experiences. As always, but especially when it comes to describing the numinous, the inadequacy of language is not only a problem for readers, but for writers too. This becomes especially clear when one reads all four of the canonical Gospels in tandem, as opposed to the way many are accustomed to reading them, in abbreviated passages or selected verses, like songs on the radio, instead of album by album, artist by artist. Read cover to cover, Sarah Rudin's four Gospels are strikingly different from one another, not in content exactly, since much of the material is repeated, but in subjectivity, language, order, and attention. Here's her version of the Lord's Prayer in Matthew. Our Father in the skies, let your name be spoken in holiness. Let your kingdom arrive. Let what you want happen on earth as in the sky. Give us today tomorrow's loaf of bread, and free us from our debts, as we too have set our debtors free. And don't bring us into the ordeal. No, rescue us from the malicious one. And in Luke, Father, Let your name be spoken in holiness. Let your kingdom arrive. Give us day by day tomorrow's loaf of bread, and set us free from our offenses, since we ourselves have set everyone bound to us likewise. And do not bring us into the ordeal. That prayer will be familiar to most Christians, yet there are many subtle differences between the two gospel versions, as well as between Rudin's versions and those of the more familiar translations. God's will, heaven, trespasses, temptation, evil. So many luscious words turn almost threadbare in her version. But perhaps the most notable and least scrutable revision is tomorrow's loaf of bread, in place of what most of us know by heart as daily bread. Rudin tackled this same translation problem in her earlier book, The Face of Water, a translator on beauty and meaning in the Bible. There, translating the verse as, "The loaf of bread, our very next loaf, give it to us day by day." And here, observing in a footnote, there is no good basis for translating this adjective as daily, a word expressing the idea of a future or tomorrow's loaf, appears the best choice among several, not very satisfactory ones, inherited from manuscript and interpretive traditions, left very unsettled. This makes it sound as if those other translators were up to no good. But as the Nestle Aland Novum Testamentum Grace notes, the words used here appear just twice in the Gospels and once in the Didache, and nowhere at all outside Christian literature. Quote, "So its meaning is difficult to determine," end quote. Some possibilities include daily, the coming day, and for existence. I don't mean to suggest that the choice a translator makes is therefore arbitrary. Indeed, each conveys something slightly different about the expectations and anxieties of those early Jesus followers around food and provisions, and consequently shapes our sense of what Jesus believes is an appropriate petitionary prayer and what we can expect from God today or tomorrow or any day. Still, one sympathizes with translators forced to parse such a tricky word and hesitates to forsake the beautiful inheritance of those earlier choices. Contemporary translators are often quick to impugn the theologies that animate earlier translations. But no translator is free of ideology. For the act of translation itself entails certain claims about the nature of sacred literature. The vernacular, for instance, was once so scandalous that church authorities dug up John Wycliffe's bones 4 decades after his death, setting fire to his skeleton and dumping what was left of him into the River Swift to punish the memory of the man who wanted to make the Bible available in English. The same Council of Constance that condemned Wycliffe also sentenced Jan Hus to death, punishing another reformer who advocated for preaching and teaching in the vernacular language of Bohemia. Bible translation was once a very dangerous business, and it remains a controversial one because, no matter how objective the translator claims to be, every linguistic or stylistic choice has theological consequences. Yet, it is not only agreement with the obvious orthodoxies that shapes many people's ongoing preferences for some of the earlier translations over modern versions, like this one from Sarah Rudin. For many, the deepest meaning of the Gospels comes from an aesthetic experience that is part of their understanding of holiness. And some of those earlier translations are truly beautiful. As a result, however philologically or linguistically flawed they may be, they remain more compelling as encounters with the grandeur and glory of God. That is why I will add Sarah Rudin's translation to my shelf of Bibles, but probably never carry it to the graveside of a friend or bring it to the bedside of a loved one. For anyone wanting to read the Gospels anew, it will be a welcome and challenging companion, but not necessarily an abiding one. Perhaps the best demonstration of that comes from the prologue to the Gospel of John, one of the first passages of Koine Greek I ever tried to translate. Rudin offers the following version of the Gospel's opening declaration. Quote, "At the inauguration was the true account." End quote. Such a translation may well be faithful in both senses, but for me at least, it will never compete with the one I have always known. In the beginning was the Word. Next, from the fiction section of the May 10th, 2021 issue of the New Yorker magazine, Balloons by Thomas McGuane. 10 years before Joan Krebs left her husband, Roger, and moved back to Cincinnati, I spotted the two of them dining alone by the bricked-up fireplace in the old Eagle Grill. She was a devoted daughter, her father a sportsman with well-bred dogs, who arrived once a year to peer at Roger and inspect the marriage. Roger always saluted his father-in-law's departure with the words, "Good riddance." In those days, Joan stirred up our town with her air of dangerous glamour and the sense that her marriage to Roger couldn't possibly last. There was nothing wrong with Roger, but talking to him was laborious. As the founder of the once famous Nomad Agency, he sold high-end recreational properties to members of his far-flung society, and he had taken on the language of his clients. After he described a drought-stricken, abandoned part of the state as a tightly held neighborhood, he came to be known as Tightly Held Krebs, or TH. In the areas of Montana that were subject to his creative hyperbole, people bought god-awful properties, believing that they were an acquired taste. Renowned for his many closings, Roger was on the road a lot. And this worked perfectly for Joan and me. Joan made it clear at the beginning of our affair that this was not her first rodeo. She added, "I never do it to get anywhere." That was all the justification we needed. I thought of Benjamin Franklin's obscure dictum about using venery and was reassured that our girl Joan was more ethical than that early American icon. I wouldn't say I envied Roger, and I may even have enjoyed the limitations. I had all the advantages without the cares. The little I knew of their love life was a glancing mention of Roger's vocalizations and importuning. Joan said she felt as if she were being regaled by him. I regret that I fell in love with her, and worse, never got over it. When I stopped at their table at the Eagle, Roger rose to his feet, pressed his napkin to his chest, and gave me a hearty welcome. Hearty by Roger's somewhat dainty standards, that is. I hugged Joan when she stood, running the tip of my forefinger up the small of her back and feeling her shiver. She rewarded me with a twinkle. The three of us sat, and they beamed at me with intense curiosity. There were several ways of viewing Roger. The nicest one credited him with enthusiasm and bonhomie, and this really was more helpful than, say, applying the standards used in one of Hemingway's cafe scenes, where the queries were all about who was or wasn't a phony. When Joan, Roger, and I sat down together, we were, strictly speaking, three phonies. There were a good many non-phonies scattered around the dining room. They looked rather dull. "You've come at the right time to settle a gentle dispute," Roger sang. "Joan says that I alone approve of the fellow in the subway who shot the muggers. Please take my side. Mugging should be risky as speeding or mountain climbing." "Four boys were shot," Joan said, leaning on her elbows and seizing her head. I glanced her way, and she held my gaze, her imperturbable face breaking slowly into a smile. No chance Roger would note any of this midway through his mugging aria. "Risk," he went on. "Look at all the deaths on K2. When you set out to rob, beat, or knife people, you should share in the peril. I want muggers to know that it's a dangerous sport. Every game has rules. My hat's off to the stout-hearted fellow who filled them with lead. He could have been stabbed or something. Knives! They had knives!" Quite inadvertently, as my hand rested in my lap, my fingers touched Jones. I let them intertwine. Roger noticed, after all. "A little wine?" he asked. "Some candles?" "Good one." But even this didn't stop him. He looked up and thought. "In school, we had to write an essay on one of Dante's circles of hell," he said. "We could pick whatever circle we wanted." "I picked the sea of excrement," he smiled. "I'm a realist, you see." Joan and Roger once came to my parents' house for a visit. My father can be formal with new people, and they seemed wildly animated. Dad was charming and cordial, but when they left, he said, "I wouldn't piss on him if he was on fire, and I wouldn't trust the wife farther than I could throw her." I was wrong to think that Roger would just find someone else. When Joan left him, he went steadily downhill. He closed the agency, and after a few years, almost no one remembered the moniker Tightly Held Krebs or his spectacular commissions. He was known as the man who had occupied every bar stool in town and fallen off a few. He kept a little pistol in his pocket and took a shot at a mad man in the Mad Hatter bar, but missed and was forgiven. He was not the sort of person who should have had a gun in his pocket. He sued so many people frivolously that the courts classified him as a vexatious litigant. He went on seeing me, and in fact all the doctors in town. Inevitably, I served as an audience for the various tributes in his remarkable diction that he directed to the memory of Joan. Age and alcohol had given him an eerie, brittle quality, and some of the lapses of wet brain. I sensed, rightly I think, that all of this was meant to pry out of me whether Joan and I had had, in his parlance, a bit of a flutter. I won't deny that it made me anxious. Roger sat before me on a chair next to my examining table, a crumpled man, with a high forehead showing thin blue veins. He began to speak as though others, too, awaited his remarks. Nothing fortified Joan like a libation presented at an unexpected hour, adding to the gaiety of nations. It was Joan, on our first hiking trip, who surprised the pot hunters of Utah, forcing their retreat. Joan was a stranger to fear. And so on. The visuals that ran through my mind of Roger's present life, falling in and out of low bars, made it hard to follow his speech. She arrived with college friends, a pair of lissome suffragettes. She caught my eye, and I made my play. Joan was a long-legged, taped-ankle thoroughbred, but there was a snag. She only had eyes for cowboys. I took a stand. I explained that the ones in the big hats were premature ejaculators. Whatever experience she'd had, that seemed to ring a bell. Roger's hands were shaking. I once spent a December night in the Stockman with Roger while he ranted about his long-ago clients. "I'm well rid of those fat cats and the Range Rovers," he said. When we left the bar, he buttoned his big coat tightly before struggling into his side-swiped red Mustang convertible with its duct-taped top. A pair of teetering patrons observed Roger's efforts to climb into the car. One said, "Perfect," and the other said, "Seriously." As he continued to summarize his life with Joan, I fought off my daydreaming to note that he seemed to be heading somewhere, and indeed he was. My guess was that he was going to demand a direct answer about Joan and me. But I was wrong. Roger thought that I was the right doc to euthanize him. I'm not feeling depressed, but I am ready to go, he said. I won't feel a thing. He dropped his hands flat on the table and tilted back. Roger, you're the picture of health, and besides, no, no, and no, I said. I couldn't possibly put you to sleep. Around here, assisted suicide was murder. Roger was weeping. He was a terrible little man. Whatever else happened to the health of old aristocrats, it was rare for them to be fat. And I suppose there might have been some satisfaction in granting his wish. But the thought of providing such a service to a man with whose wife I had been intimate made me queasy. Some goody-two-shoes in law enforcement would have been on me like a cheap suit. I was close to retirement, owned property in Del Mar, and didn't want to make new friends in prison showers. He spoke more plainly. I want to be with Joan. I was a good husband. I forgave her. He stared at me hard. I'm not proud to say that I considered his little pistol. I want to go to heaven and be with her there. Is Joan dead, Roger? Yes, Roger said. Let me show you something. He stood and began looking through his pockets, doing a frantic St. Vitus's dance until he pulled a wrinkled page from inside his jacket, Joan's obituary. I read it quickly. It didn't say much about Joan, except that she was survived by her wife, a cosmetic dentist, and their dog, Olive. It said more about Joan's great-grandfather, who had owned barges on the Ohio River and built one of the banks in Cincinnati. Did you know she was a dyke? Roger asked. No. You can't tell by looking at them, can you? Of course not. I saw this, and you could have knocked me over with a feather. He crumpled up the obituary, then gazed at it without seeming to know where to put it. He threw it at me. With effort, I came up with something thoroughly tepid. Roger, she's been gone from you for many years. I felt the pressure, but I didn't tip my hand despite Roger's glare. That's right, but I always thought she'd come back, he said. Now be a good little doctor and grant my wish. I'd like to be on my way. You just sashay over to my house with some sayonara beans and we'll call it even. I won't help you, Roger. I hope you'll understand. Roger got to his feet and, plucking a tissue from the box beside my examining table, turned to me with an expression of lofty annoyance. You tin pot sawbones. You've never done a bit of good, not even on the smallest matters. It took a moment for me to react. You can always do it yourself, Rog. Lots of people have. And I delivered this amiably, a helpful tip. Close the door to your garage and start the car, for Christ's sake. Once he left, I brooded over the corned beef and sauerkraut sandwich I'd brought to the office. After lunch, I took a walk. No accident, a long walk I knew well. Climbing the sandstone bluff behind the clinic, which at the top opened onto a somnolent grassland that seemed to extend forever to the snowy range in the distance. Almost a mile away was the deserted Lutheran church where Joan and Roger were married. It was so picturesque that people still dusted it off from time to time for weddings. It was a place I found heartening whenever I felt inspired to walk so far, especially on a day when I had let my anger and sadness get away from me. Lifted by the breeze, the long grass looked like silk. Small circular shapes of several colors bobbed and drifted like ghosts in the summer air above it. I had it in my mind, maybe from childhood, that a soul was something that floated around and went where it pleased. I thought of Joan dead, her green, now deceased eyes, her contempt for everyone who was not interested in her looks. I guess she'd had enough of bozos like Roger and me. I walked a long way toward those bobbing ectoplasms before I understood that they were just married balloons, floating on zephyrs. One more couple into the unknown. I remembered the crowd of out-of-towners at Joan and Roger's wedding and how they'd praised the quaint old church with Norman Rockwell references. I had never seen two such good-looking people as Joan and Roger at their peak. I felt the appeal of meeting up with Joan in the next world, except that, unlike Roger, I didn't believe in it. I hadn't heard boo about her in years, dead or alive. When you were in Cincinnati, she once told me, it was hard to tell the difference. I'd wanted to go there to see her, but she'd said, "Stay out of Cincinnati, you." Had our relationship continued, I suppose, I would have learned firsthand why we had no business being within 10 miles of each other. So Roger wanted to be put to sleep and drift to Joan like one of those balloons sailing over the church where their marriage was consecrated. A few of them caught in the branches of the honey locust that shades its door. Do people really have such faith anymore? It was never easy to see what those two were doing together in the first place. But accepting that it must have been what they wanted helped me to decide to grant Roger's wish. And I did. He made a tidy job of it, seated in the Eames chair, one of his remaining luxuries. Roger took the ingredients I'd supplied and then dialed 911, telling the operator that he had fallen and couldn't arise. By the time help arrived, Roger was gone. I soon learned that the note he'd left behind thanked me by name for ending his life. So it seems he knew after all and made sure I would be repaid accordingly. I had a full slate of patients that day, but I thought it best to wait at home. And now, from the A Reporter at Large section of the May 10th, 2021 issue of the New Yorker magazine, how the Pentagon started taking UFOs seriously. For decades, flying saucers were a punchline. Then the U.S. government got over the taboo. By Gideon Lewis Krause. On May 9, 2001, Stephen M. Greer took the lectern at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., in pursuit of the truth about unidentified flying objects. Greer, an emergency room physician in Virginia and an outspoken UFOologist, believed that the government had long withheld from the American people its familiarity with alien visitations. He had founded the Disclosure Project in 1993 in an attempt to penetrate the sanctums of conspiracy. Greer's reckoning that day featured some 20 speakers. He provided, in support of his claims, a 492-page dossier called the Disclosure Project Briefing Document. For public officials too busy to absorb such a vast tract of suppressed knowledge, Greer had prepared a 95-page executive summary of the Disclosure Project briefing document. After some throat clearing, the executive summary began with a brief summary, which included a series of bullet points outlining what amounted to the greatest secret in human history. Over several decades, according to Greer, untold numbers of alien craft had been observed in our planet's airspace. They were able to reach extreme velocities with no visible means of lift or propulsion, and to perform stunning maneuvers at G-forces that would turn a human pilot to soup. Some of these extraterrestrial spaceships had been downed, retrieved, and studied since at least the 1940s, and possibly as early as the 1930s. Efforts to reverse engineer such extraordinary machines had led to, quote, significant technological breakthroughs in energy generation, end quote. These operations had mostly been classified as cosmic top secret, a tier of clearance 38 levels above that typically granted to the commander-in-chief. Why, Greer asked, had such transformative technologies been hidden for so long? This was obvious. The, quote, social, economic, and geopolitical order of the world, end quote, was at stake. The idea that aliens had frequented our planet had been circulating among UFOologists since the post-war years, when a Polish emigre, George Adamski, claimed to have rendezvoused with a race of kindly, Nordic-looking Venusians who were disturbed by the domestic and interplanetary effects of nuclear bomb tests. In the summer of 1947, an alien spaceship was said to have crashed near Roswell, New Mexico. Conspiracy theorists believed that vaguely anthropomorphic bodies had been recovered there, and that the crash debris had been entrusted to private military contractors who raced to unlock alien hardware before the Russians could. Documents unearthed after the fall of the Soviet Union suggested that the anxiety about an arms race supercharged by alien technology was mutual. All of this, UFOologists claimed, had been covered up by Majestic 12, a clandestine paragovernmental organization convened under executive order by President Truman. President Kennedy was assassinated because he planned to level with Premier Khrushchev. Kennedy had confided in Marilyn Monroe, thereby sealing her fate. Representative Stephen Schiff of New Mexico spent years trying to get to the bottom of the Roswell incident, only to die of, quote, cancer, end quote. Greer's executive summary was woolly, but discerning readers could find within it answers to many of the most frequently asked questions about UFOs. Assuming, as Greer did, that UFOs are helmed by extraterrestrials. Why are they so elusive? Because the aliens are monitoring us. Why? Because they are discomfited by our aspiration to weaponize space. Have we shot at them? Yes. Should we shoot at them? No. Really? Yes. Why not? They're friendly. How do we know? Obviously, any civilization capable of routine interstellar travel could terminate our civilization in a nanosecond, if that was their intent. That we are still breathing the free air of Earth is abundant testimony to the non-hostile nature of these ET civilizations. One obviously question seems not to have occurred to Greer. Why, if these spacecraft are so advanced, do they allegedly crash all the time? At the press conference, Greer appeared in thin-framed glasses, a baggy funereal suit, and a red tie askew in a starched collar. "I know many in the media would like to talk about little green men," he said, "but in reality, the subject is laughed at because it is so serious. I have had grown men weep who are in the Pentagon, who are members of Congress, and who have said to me, 'What are we going to do?' Well, here is what we will do. We will see that this matter is properly disclosed." Among the other speakers was Clifford Stone, a retired Army sergeant, who purported to have visited crash sites and seen aliens both dead and alive. Stone said that he had cataloged 57 species, many of them humanoid.
You have individuals that look very much like you and myself that could walk among us and you wouldn't even notice the difference," he said.
Leslie Keene, an independent investigative journalist and a novice UFO researcher who had worked with Greer, watched the proceedings with unease. She had recently published an article in the Boston Globe about a new omnibus of compelling evidence concerning UFOs, and she couldn't understand why a speaker would make an unsupported assertion about alien cadavers when he could be talking about hard data. To Keene, the corpus of genuinely baffling reports deserved scientific scrutiny, regardless of how you felt about aliens.
"Well, there were some good people at that conference, but some of them were making outrageous, grandiose claims," Keene told me. "I knew then that I had to walk away."
Greer had hoped that the members of the media would cover the event, and they did, with frolicsome derision. He had also hoped that Congress would hold hearings. By all accounts, it did not.
UFOologists have perpetual faith in the imminence of disclosure, a term of art for the government's rapturous confession of its profound UFO knowledge. In the years after the press conference, the expected announcement was apparently postponed by the events of September 11th, the War on Terror, and the financial crisis. In 2009, Greer issued a special presidential briefing for President Barack Obama, in which he claimed that the inaction of Obama's predecessors had, quote, led to an unacknowledged crisis that will be the greatest of your presidency, end quote. Obama's response remains unknown. But in 2011, UFOologists filed two petitions with the White House, to which the Office of Science and Technology Policy responded that it could find no evidence to suggest that any, quote, extraterrestrial presence has contacted or engaged any member of the human race, end quote. The government may not have been in regular touch with exotic civilizations, but it had been keeping something from its citizens. By 2017, Keene was the author of a best-selling UFO book and was known for what she has termed borrowing from the political scientist Alexander Wendt, a militantly agnostic approach to the phenomenon. On December 16th of that year, in a front-page story in the Times, Keene, together with two Times journalists, revealed that the Pentagon had been running a surreptitious UFO program for 10 years. The article included two videos, recorded by the Navy, of what were being described in official channels as unidentified aerial phenomena, or UAP. In blogs and on podcasts, UFOologists began to refer to December 2017 as shorthand for the moment the taboo began to lift. Joe Rogan, the popular podcast host, has often mentioned the article, praising Keene's work as having precipitated a cultural shift. "It's a dangerous subject for someone because you're open to ridicule," he said in an episode this spring. "But now you could say, listen, this is not something to be mocked anymore. There's something to this." Since then, high-level officials have publicly conceded their bewilderment about UAP without shame or apology. Last July, Senator Marco Rubio, the former acting chairman of the Select Committee on Intelligence, spoke on CBS News about mysterious flying objects in restricted airspace. "We don't know what it is," he said, "and it isn't ours." In December, in a video interview with The Economist Tyler Cowen, the former CIA director John Brennan admitted, somewhat torturously, that he didn't know what to think. Quote, "Some of the phenomena we're going to be seeing continues to be unexplained and might, in fact, be some type of phenomena that is the result of something that we don't yet understand and that could involve some type of activity that some might say constitutes a different form of life." Last summer, David Norquist, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, announced the formal existence of the Unidentified Aerial Phenomena Task Force. The 2021 Intelligence Authorization Act, signed this past December, stipulated that the government had 180 days to gather and analyze data from disparate agencies. Its report is expected in June. In a recent interview with Fox News, John Ratcliffe, the former director of National Intelligence, emphasized that the issue was no longer to be taken lightly. "When we talk about sightings," he said, "we are talking about objects that have been seen by Navy or Air Force pilots, or have been picked up by satellite imagery, that frankly engage in actions that are difficult to explain, movements that are hard to replicate, that we don't have the technology for, or are traveling at speeds that exceed the sound barrier without a sonic boom." Since 2017, Keene has covered the UFO beat for the Times, sharing a byline with Ralph Blumenthal on a handful of stories. They have steered clear of such genre mainstays as crop circles and Nazca lines, but their most recent article, published last July, veered into fringe territory. In it, they referred to a, quote, a series of unclassified slides, end quote, of somewhat uncertain lineage, but apparently known at congressional briefings, that mentioned, quote, off-world, end quote, vehicles and, quote, crash retrievals, end quote. Keene told me in an uncharacteristically hesitant, but nonetheless matter-of-fact way, that she had begun to come around to the idea that UFO fragments had been hoarded somewhere. In 2019, Luis Elizondo had suggested to Tucker Carlson that such detritus existed. He then quickly invoked his security oath. Keene cites Jacques Vallée, perhaps the most famous living UFOologist and the basis for François Truffaut's character in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, who has been working with Gary Nolan, a Stanford immunologist, to analyze purported crash material for scientific publication. In the story, Keene and Blumenthal wrote that Harry Reid believed that crashes of vehicles from other worlds had occurred and that retrieved materials had been studied secretly for decades, often by aerospace companies under government contracts. A former Pentagon official told me that he found Keene's evidence wanting. "There are terms in Leslie's slides that we don't use, stuff we would never say," he said. "It doesn't pass the smell test." But when I asked him whether he thought that there might be recovered debris somewhere, he paused for a surprisingly long time. He finally said, "I couldn't say yes like Luis Elizondo did. I honestly don't know." He continued, "There are guys who spent their lives studying stuff like Roswell and died with no answers. Are we all going to die with no answers?" This article was edited for length. Well, we've run out of time for this episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Again, that number is 919-832-5138. Well, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. It was a pleasure reading for you. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.